I was thinking about how we're just so incredibly spoiled by modern storytelling
Oh,
today.
yeah, totally.
I mean, you sit down, you turn on a 10-hour streaming series, and absolutely everything is just spelled out for you.
Right, it's all right there.
Yeah, you get the character's tragic backstory delivered in this neatly packaged flashback. You hear their inner monologues. You see the exact color of the curtains in their childhood bedroom. It's basically all handed to you on a silver platter.
Well, we expect a certain level of narrative hand-holding. We want the author or the director to explicitly tell us what to think, who to root for, and frankly, why a character is behaving a certain way.
Exactly. But then you pick up an ancient text, and suddenly all of that hand-holding just vanishes. It's like you've been dropped in the middle of a wilderness with, like, a magnifying glass. You
Yeah.
can't just passively consume it. You have to actively investigate it. So welcome to the deep dive. We have a really fascinating mission today.
We do.
We are taking a stack of source material from Dr. Stephen D. Mathewson regarding the exegesis of Old Testament narratives. And we are going to extract the ultimate shortcut to reading these ancient texts like a master detective.
It's a great toolkit.
Right. So we're looking at a framework Dr. Mathewson calls the ACTS method. That stands for action, characters, talking, and setting. But for this specific deep dive, we are zeroing in entirely on the C and the T. So the mechanics of the characters, how they're built, and what they say.
Which is profoundly important for, really anyone interested in literature or history or psychology. Understanding how these ancient authors constructed their characters and their dialogue, it reveals the mechanics of how human nature and storytelling have fundamentally operated for thousands of years.
Wow, yeah.
We're basically looking at the foundational blueprints of narrative long before anyone even invented the modern novel.
So if characters are the engine of any story, I want to start by looking at how we classify them. Because my instinct, just based on every movie I've ever seen, is to just slot everyone into neat little boxes.
Right, the standard tropes.
Exactly. You have your protagonist, your antagonist, and your side characters. But the source material throws up this massive caution sign here. It argues we shouldn't just, slap labels on characters, but instead look at their actual literary function.
And that distinction changes absolutely everything about how you read a text. We get so hung up on the label of hero or villain that we completely miss how characters are operating mechanically in relation to one another.
Let me test this, because I think I understand the concept, but actually applying it feels a little tricky.
Sure.
Let's take the most famous underdog story of all time, David and Goliath. For Samuel 17.
Classic.
Right. If characters define the plot, then Goliath is the ultimate villain, right? I
Yeah.
mean, he's the massive, terrifying antagonist that the whole plot revolves around. David is the protagonist, Goliath is the antagonist. It's the classic hero versus monster trope.
Well, from a purely cinematic standpoint, it definitely looks that way.
Yeah.
But at a literary level, the source argues that reading is actually fundamentally flawed. Yeah, because if you zoom out and look at the actual narrative structure for 1 Samuel 15 all the way through 2 Samuel 9, the overarching plot isn't about defeating Philistines at all.
Wait, really?
No, it's an extended, incredibly tense argument about who is the rightful king of Israel.
Oh, so the true conflict isn't even on the battlefield.
Not at all. The true conflict, the actual protagonist versus antagonist dynamic, is David versus King Saul. The narrator is meticulously building a case for why David, who is from a completely new, unproven family line, is the better choice for the throne over the established king.
Wait, so if Saul's the antagonist, what is Goliath? I mean, the
Yeah.
guy with the giant spear trying to kill the hero has to be something more than just a background extra, right?
Goliath functions as a foil.
A foil, like a
Yeah, he is a contrasting figure. Think of him as a narrative device used to expose the true antagonist. Goliath's massive challenge isn't there to just show us how scary monsters are. It's there to reveal the stark differences in faith and leadership between David and Saul.
I see.
Because when Goliath issues his challenge, Saul cowers in his tent, completely paralyzed by fear. But David steps up with absolute conviction. So the giant is basically just a tool the author uses to prove Saul's illegitimacy and David's courage.
That completely flips the script. Goliath is essentially a prop to force Saul's failure into the light.
Exactly. And what's even more fascinating is how a character's function can shift dynamically from one chapter to the next.
Okay.
Let's look at 1 Samuel 25. David is still our central protagonist, but he is completely losing his temper. A wealthy man named Nabal disrespects him, and David just abandons all his supposed virtue. He marches out with his men to get violent, bloody revenge.
Which, I mean, that would effectively ruin his own destiny. If he slaughters his own people, he completely destroys his claim to be a righteous king.
Precisely. So the narrative needs an intervention. And Abigail, Nabal's wife, steps in. Now, in a traditional reading, you might just sideline her as a minor character or a foil.
Right.
But in the mechanics of this specific episode, she functions as the actual hero. She intercepts David, talks him down, and completely saves him from himself. For that chapter, David is not the hero. Abigail is.
Oh, wow. So you really have to watch what the character is doing in that specific moment rather than just relying on their permanent resume.
You do. And if we jump ahead to 2 Samuel 11 and 12, the story of Bathsheba, David's role shifts into incredibly dark territory.
Right, yeah.
He commits adultery and murder. He is still the protagonist, but he is acting abhorrently. And in this scenario, Uriah the Hittite, Bathsheba's husband, becomes the contrasting foil. He demonstrates profound honor while this so-called hero shows absolute deceit.
And what about Bathsheba in all of this? I mean, she's the catalyst for the whole event.
Well, the source points out a really crucial nuance here. While her presence is critical, her narrative function is actually minor in terms of agency. Yeah, she is acted upon. Well, she functions purely as a victim and as an agent of David's misuse of power. The text doesn't give us her internal monologue or her grand strategy because her literary function in that moment is just to highlight David's descent.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit more. If these authors are relying entirely on the function of a character to drive the plot, how do we even picture them?
What do you mean?
Well, because when I read a modern novel, the author spends like 3 pages telling me about the protagonist's piercing green eyes and their messy hair, the way their leather jacket smells. But ancient texts just don't do that at all. Honestly, doesn't that make for a really dry, boring reading experience?
I mean, it might feel dry if you're expecting what literary scholar Mir Sternberg calls realistic fullness.
Realistic fullness.
Yeah. He points out that modern authors love elaborate descriptions that serve no other purpose than painting a vivid picture in your mind's eye. The source uses John Grisham or Louis L'Amour as examples.
Oh, sure.
Those authors will tell you all about a character's wide, bony shoulders or the slight tinge of red in their brown hair.
Right. They set the mood. They build a whole visual world for you to step into.
But Robert Alter, who is a leading literary scholar on these texts, he notes that ancient storytellers use a relentlessly lean, spare style. It's like a quick pencil sketch.
A pencil sketch. I like that.
They give you the absolute barest hints about physical appearance. And they do this for a brilliant reason. It creates intense focus. Because the details are so incredibly scarce when a physical description actually does show up on the page.
It has to mean something.
Exactly. It is never just setting the mood. It is a load-bearing structure for the plot.
I see where you're going with this. If an author only uses like 3 adjectives in an entire book, you better pay serious attention to those 3 words.
You better.
Yeah.
Genesis 39 bothers to tell us that Joseph is a very good-looking man. Why?
Not just for flavor, I'm guessing?
Not at all. It's the mechanical setup for the sexual advance from Potiphar's wife. Genesis 27 tells us Esau is an incredibly hairy man. That's the specific detail that allows his brother Jacob to cover his own arms in animal skins and successfully impersonate him to their blind father.
So every detail is a tool waiting to be used.
Which brings us to one of the most vivid examples of this in the entire source material. The story of Ehud and Eglon in Judges chapter 3.
All right.
The narrator gives us 2 very specific, highly unusual physical descriptions. It tells us that Ehud, the Israelite, is left-handed, and it tells us that Eglon, the oppressive Moabite king, is very fat.
Okay, let me pause you right there, because reading that today, it feels like random trivia or even, honestly, ancient fat shaming.
Right.
But based on what you just said about the pencil sketch, these have to be mechanical elements of the plot. Is this the ancient equivalent of a movie director showing us the ticking bomb under the table?
They are the entire plot. Think about the mechanics of ancient security. Ehud is going in to see King Eglon to deliver a tribute. He has to pass through the royal guards, which is essentially ancient customs.
Right, the pat down.
Exactly. In the ancient world, almost all warriors were right-handed. They wore their swords on their left thigh so they could draw the weapon across their body. Therefore, when guards pat someone down, they focus heavily on the left side.
Oh, wow. because Ehud is left-handed.
He hides a foot-long, double-edged dagger on his right thigh.
So they completely miss it.
He completely bypasses the standard security pat-down because the guards simply didn't check the right side thoroughly. He smuggles the weapon right into the king's private chambers undetected.
That is brilliant narrative payoff.
Mm.
But what about Eglon being very fat? How does that function beyond just an insult?
Oh, it's crucial to the escape plan. And there's a layer of dark, crass irony here, too. Eglon's name actually translates to calf.
Oh, no way.
Yes. So the narrator is subtly portraying him as a fatted calf ready for slaughter. When Ehud draws that hidden dagger with his left hand and assassinates the king, the text is graphically specific. Eglon is so remarkably obese that his flesh completely swallows the blade. The fat closes right over the hilt.
So the weapon disappears entirely.
Exactly. When Ehud slips out and Eglon's attendants finally check on the king, they find him dead on the floor. But they don't immediately realize he's been assassinated because there is no visible weapon.
Which buys him time.
It completely delays their reaction. They waste critical time trying to figure out what happened, which gives Ehud the exact head start he needs to escape and rally an army.
That is just a masterclass in showing, not telling.
It really is. The source also points out how behavior replaces exposition. Like in Judges 17 and 18, the narrator never explicitly calls Micah corrupt. His actions simply show it when read against the backdrop of the Torah.
But this raises a huge question for me. If physical descriptions are that rare, and they're only used as mechanical plot devices, how do ancient authors actually flesh out a character's essence? I mean, if you aren't describing your appearance, how do you signal to the reader who this person really is on the inside?
Well, you use their name.
Their name.
Yeah, in the ancient world, naming was a massive primary method of characterization. The source shares a fantastic modern parallel to help us understand this. The author mentions doing public address broadcasting for high school basketball games in Montana.
Okay.
Specifically for Native American teams. And he would read off these incredible, highly specific names. Tawny Whistling Elk. Jonathan Takes Enemy. Elvis Old Bull.
Wow. Those names carry so much weight.
They do.
They aren't just phonetic sounds, you know. They reflect cultural heritage, circumstances of birth, or virtues that their family hopes will define them.
And that is exactly how names function in Old Testament narratives. Scholar Jean-Louis Scott notes that ancient authors use these names to signal destiny, character, and very often deep cutting irony.
Let's unpack the irony part, because I know the text is full of characters whose names seem to be in direct conflict with their actions.
Nabal is a perfect example of that. We mentioned him earlier as the wealthy man who disrespected David. His name literally translates to fool in Hebrew.
I can't imagine naming your child Fool.
Well, the text is likely using a descriptive moniker that stuck to him later in life, but the literary function is undeniable. When the reader hears the name Nabal, they're immediately primed for his arrogant, self-destructive behavior.
It sets the expectation.
Exactly. It creates a psychological expectation. Or look at the Book of Ruth. The story starts with a man named Elimelech. His name translates to, "My God is King."
That sounds incredibly devout.
It does. But what happens? A famine hits the land. And instead of trusting his king, Elimelech abandons the promised land and flees to Moab, a rival nation.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the irony of his name highlights the tragedy of his lack of faith. His wife is Naomi, which means pleasant. But after Elimelech and her sons die in Moab, she returns home broken. She walks into her hometown and tells everyone, "Don't call me pleasant, call me Mara."
Which means bitter.
Yes.
Yes. She is renaming herself to reflect the trauma she feels the Almighty has dealt her.
The name perfectly tracks the emotional journey.
Mm-hmm.
But let me push back on this for a second. If giving a name is the primary way you establish someone's dignity and character, what happens when an author purposefully refuses to use a name? Here's where it gets really interesting for me. Is withholding a name basically the ultimate ancient diss track?
It absolutely is. It is the ultimate ancient insult. It's a profound way of showing absolute disdain or signaling that a person simply isn't worthy of being remembered by history.
Do we have specific examples of that in the text?
Several. In Genesis 21, Sarah is deeply resentful of Hagar's son, Ishmael, but she refuses to actually say his name out loud. She just refers to him coldly as the son whom Hagar the Egyptian had born. It's a calculated psychological dismissal. And David does the exact same thing to Goliath. He never once calls him Goliath. He strips him of his identity and just calls him this uncircumcised Philistine.
He reduces this terrifying legendary giant to a mere biological and ethnic label. That is a massive power move.
It really is. But the most striking example brings us back to the Book of Ruth. There is a closer relative who has the legal right to redeem Ruth and the family land before Boaz does.
Right.
But when push comes to shove, the man refuses because he doesn't want to risk his own financial estate. So when Boaz addresses him at the city gate, the Hebrew text uses the phrase Poloni Almoni.
Poloni Almoni. What does that mean?
It translates roughly to Mr. So-and-so or Mr. What's-his-name.
No way.
Yes. The narrator is actively erasing this man from the historical record. He had the chance to do the honorable thing and save a destitute widow, and he passed. So the narrator decides he does not get the honor of a name. He is condemned to history as Mr. So-and-so.
That is brutal. Come sit over here, Mr. What's-his-name.
Conversely, you have names like Isaac. Yitzhak translates to laughter, which beautifully tracks Sarah's shift from disbelief to profound joy.
Okay, so we've looked at the C in ACTS. We've seen their functions, their sparse physical sketches, and the profound weight of their names. But eventually, these characters have to open their mouths. How does dialogue operate in a text that is so incredibly lean?
To understand this, the source references Norman MacLean's novella, A River Runs Through It. Near the end of the story, a father and son are discussing the tragic death of the younger brother.
Oh, yeah, I know that scene.
The dialogue is remarkably sparse. It's not full of sweeping emotional monologues. But it culminates in this quiet realization. You can love completely without complete understanding. MacLean packs the ultimate meaning of the entire book right inside that brief exchange.
It's not just small talk. It's the core philosophy of the narrative.
Exactly. Scholars like Robert Alter and Cynthia Miller point out that in ancient narratives, dialogue carries a huge freight of meaning. The narrator rarely pauses to give you a theological lecture. Instead, they pack the payload into the mouths of the characters. Speech functions as the interpretive key for the entire plot.
So if a character is talking, they're either revealing who they are or they're delivering the thesis statement of the story.
Yes. Think about how speech gives us immediate insight into character traits. The narrator doesn't waste time explaining that Esau is a man ruled by instant gratification and physical appetites.
Right. They just show it.
They just have Esau barge into a tent, exhausted, and bluntly demand of his brother, "Give me some of that red stuff." You know exactly who he is from one sentence.
And you contrast that with Abigail in 1 Samuel 25.
Exactly.
She delivers this incredibly eloquent, highly metaphorical, persuasive speech to stop David from seeking revenge. Her wisdom is entirely proven by her sophisticated use of language.
Perfectly said. Another function is summarizing the narrative, often through poetry stepping in, like Adam in Genesis 2, or Hannah's song in 1 Samuel 2, or highlighting contrast. Think of Joseph's long theological refusal to Potiphar's wife versus her blunt two-word Hebrew demand, "Come lie with me."
Wow, the contrast there is stark. And as for the thesis statement idea, I think of Joseph at the very end of his massive 14-chapter saga in Genesis. After all the betrayal, the slavery, the false imprisonment, he finally looks at the brothers who sold him and says, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good."
That one sentence is the interpretive lens for everything the reader just experienced. The character does the heavy lifting of explaining the narrative's purpose.
But this makes me wonder about the narrator themselves. If the character is the one delivering the main message, is the ancient narrator just a silent camera operator? Or do they occasionally step in, like a movie voiceover, to give us a spoiler or some insider info?
They do, but they use it sparingly. It's a technique we can call the editorial whisper. The narrator is omniscient, and occasionally they hit the pause button to give the reader insider information that the characters inside the story simply do not have.
Oh, that would dramatically change how you experience the tension. Give me an example of an editorial whisper.
The most famous one is likely Genesis 22. It's the terrifying story where God tells Abraham to sacrifice his son Isaac. At the very beginning of the chapter, before a single step is taken up the mountain, the narrator leans in and tells the reader, "God was testing Abraham."
But Abraham doesn't know that.
No, Abraham is living the absolute trauma of the moment.
Yeah.
He believes this is a lethal reality. But because the narrator gave us that editorial whisper up front, we read the entire agonizing journey through a completely different psychological lens.
We have the safety net of knowing it's a test.
Exactly. The character doesn't. Another powerful example is Genesis 38. Judah's first two sons, Ur and Onan, die unexpectedly. Judah assumes his daughter-in-law, Tamar, is cursed, and he blames her.
Which leads him to make terrible decisions regarding her future.
But the narrator steps in and tells the reader the truth. Ur and Onan were wicked in Yahweh's sight, and Yahweh put them to death. Judah doesn't have that information. He is operating on a totally false assumption. The editorial whisper allows the reader to see the divine causality that the characters are completely blind to.
So what does this all mean? It's incredible how much machinery is working beneath the surface of these texts.
Yeah.
We've looked at characters not as fixed heroes or villains, but as shifting literary functions.
Right.
We've seen how a lack of description turns a single left hand or a hidden dagger into a narrative ticking bomb. We've explored the profound irony of names and how a single line of dialogue can carry the theological weight of a 14-chapter saga.
It's a lot to take in.
It is. The takeaway here seems to be that reading ancient texts requires intense, active participation. You can't be passive. You can't just get bogged down in what isn't there. You have to lock in on what is actually on the page, because every single detail is a deliberate, load-bearing choice by the narrator.
It demands your full attention. Absolutely. And if we can take these ancient mechanics and apply them to our own lives for a moment.
Please do.
Think back to the concept of Poloni Almoni, Mr. So-and-so. The idea that withholding a name is a calculated tactic to erase someone's legacy or dismiss their dignity.
It's a terrifying power to have over someone's story.
But we use that power every single day. Think about how we tell stories to our friends, or how history is written today, or even how we consume modern media and the news. Who is being named and who is being carefully curated into an anonymous Mr. So-and-so?
Oh, wow.
We might not use the phrase Mr. So-and-so, but we certainly use designations like that guy from accounting, or the crazy neighbor, or that demographic.
We strip them of their humanity to make our own narrative simpler.
Precisely. By turning them into a function, a foil, or a generic label, we make them easier to dismiss. It forces us to ask a very personal question about the stories we tell and accept as truth every day. Who currently holds the pen? When we recount an event, who are we humanizing, and who are we erasing to make ourselves look like the unquestioned protagonist?
That completely reframes how I think about the stories I tell.
Mm-hmm.
Who is getting the dignity of a name? Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive.
It was a pleasure.
Next time you pick up a book, watch a show, or even listen to a friend vent over coffee, keep your magnifying glass handy. Keep looking for those hidden pencil sketches, because the details and the missing names are never just details. We'll see you next time.